You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine. This is Lecture 7, given in Dornach on March 27, 1920. Yesterday I drew your attention to several considerations that we must take as our basis for understanding how human beings adapt to earthly and cosmic circumstances. These aspects, which were more spatial in character, must be combined with temporal aspects, because we must never forget that the human being must be seen as a totality. As a whole, each human being is in some respects a child, an adult, and an elderly person, and is organized in such a way that these three essential developmental stages are actually present simultaneously. What we accomplish along these lines today will then have to be brought together with the supersensible aspect. Only then will we be able to move on to more detailed considerations. Above all, I would like to make you aware that just as pedagogy is forced to pay attention to the difference between the various stages of childhood, from birth to the second dentition, from the second dentition to puberty, and so on, any aspect of medicine must also consider the entire human being from birth to death. As I said earlier, I will use our customary anthroposophical expressions to begin with. Toward the end, I will explore possible ways of translating these expressions for outsiders. This translation process will be easier once we have progressed a little further in our studies. First and foremost, we will need to realize, in looking at childhood, for example, that the inherent functions of the eye, capital, and the astral body, as we call these things, are in the process of just being integrated into the human being at this age. During childhood, these functions are first integrated into the organic aspect in such a way as to then be able to work with the child's flexible and elastic organic substance. At this particular stage, and especially during the ages from 7 to about 14, 15, or 16, which is the time when the etheric body must have consolidated its position in relationship to the physical body so that puberty can begin, it is not surprising to note the appearance of disturbances having to do with integrating the higher aspect of the human being into the lower. In many cases, it is possible that the elasticity of the physical body and that of the etheric body do not coincide. It is essentially the task of the astral body to bring about a balance between these physical and etheric elasticities. If they do not work together, the astral body is often obliged to strengthen its forces, and if these forces remain inadequate, the disease symptoms that then appear will require outside intervention. This is why it is common to find disease symptoms in childhood that are discharged on the physical level, as in Sydenham's chorea, for instance. Footnote: Sydenham's chorea typically occurs in children and adolescents, also called St. Vitus's dance, along with Sydenham's contracted by infection. The best known form of chorea is Huntington's, an hereditary disease, which generally occurs in adults. End of footnote. All illnesses leading to such syndromes, in which nervous or psychological disturbances occur, in addition to what is happening on the organic level, are related to the somewhat unaccustomed work the astral body is being called upon to perform, to balance the elasticity of the physical and etheric bodies. If chorea-like symptoms appear during pregnancy, the cause will be only too obvious. Pregnancy, of course, disrupts the harmony between the elasticity of the physical and etheric bodies. So, once again, you must expect the astral body to behave as it does in childhood. Therefore, in such illnesses, which occur in children and sometimes also as concomitant symptoms during pregnancy, we will have to seek remedies that increase the astral body's overall effectiveness so that its functions fall into line with its task of balancing the elasticity of the physical and etheric bodies. These are questions that will be discussed in the next few days. In contrast, and this is why I emphasized the importance of taking the patient's ages into account, you will find that diseases tending toward polyarthritis or other related symptoms appear most frequently from the mid-teens to late 20s. During this time, the astral body itself must establish the right relationship to the physical and etheric bodies. If it is insufficiently prepared, for example, if the right things have not been done in childhood to prepare it will be unable to bring about the right relationship. As a consequence, disease symptoms will appear either at this age or in the next stage of life. This is the important point, to include the time factor in our study of illnesses. If I may be permitted to express myself somewhat one-sidedly, we must not assume that nature has arranged the human organism in a way that makes it as easy and comfortable as possible for us to simply read off the cure. We tend to mistakenly assume that it should be as easy as possible to discover how to cure a patient. In a certain respect, the law of similars, the principle of, quote, like cures like, close quote, is correct. It may happen, however, that the primary syndrome occurs in one stage of life, but the remedy can induce similar symptoms only during a different stage. For example, certain medications may provoke a disease process, a specific complex of symptoms, in a person who has not yet reached the age of 20. But those same medications may become true remedies in a later stage of the person's life. This is what must be considered when we hear the frequently emphasized statement, quote, like cures like, close quote. If we want to look at the overall state of health of an individual, whether healthy or sick, it is essential to know that, in a certain sense, the human being lives through two polar opposite stages of life, and is exposed to different influences in youth, specifically the influences of Saturn, Jupiter, and Mars, the planets beyond the Sun. Then, at a later age, when the individual is more influenced by the inner planets, Venus, Mercury, and Moon, if I need to name them in accordance with what we said yesterday. The Moon influence, however, appears earliest and most obviously. This example points out once again that we must always combine the spatial factor with the temporal in studying the human being. Only if we do so will we be able to see in the right light certain phenomena that appear during a person's lifetime. Later, when we focus on details, we will also constantly touch on how we must proceed in order to see these relationships that are so necessary for understanding the human being in the right light. You see, what works on the human being commences before birth and even before conception. In researching these issues, I have often wondered why so many disease processes in conventional medical literature are described as being of unknown origin, quote, etiology unknown, close quote. This stems from total disregard for the fact that the extra-telluric complex of forces we pointed to yesterday is already present as an individual approaches conception, not only birth, but also conception, and that all the forces that work on an individual in this way later produce the opposite effects. This means that certain processes present before conception produce counter-effects after conception, or especially after birth. Sometimes all we can observe is what begins to take effect in a person's life after birth, a counter-effect of sorts to what was present before conception in the overall context of natural existence. What I have just said relates especially strongly to everything having to do with ossification and sclerosis. These are processes that have counterparts in the time before conception. As entirely normal, organic, formative processes, they counter the process of expansion or dispersion that is active in the human being prior to conception. It is extremely important to look at this fact. We will not be able to control the sclerotic process if we cannot relate it in this way to a suprahuman and extra-telluric process that precedes conception, even if this extra-telluric principle later appears within the human being, either after birth or beginning with conception. All of these necessary forces can also overstep a certain boundary, the midpoint of their oscillation, so to speak. In some respects, processes such as sclerosis or ossification oscillate around a midpoint, and it is possible for them to overshoot the mark and become too strong. They then appear in a very different form. Initially, they appear as predispositions, which reveal a great deal about the essential nature of an individual. If a normal process of ossification or sclerosis, or one that becomes abnormal only in its own domain in the course of a person's lifetime, swings to the other side, so that it takes place not in its own domain but in some other organ system, then the pathological counter-image of a pre-conceptional process appears. This is what we encounter in the various types of carcinoma. It is possible to look at these questions only if we really try to understand the human being's entire development and existence. Without that understanding, that is, if we cannot relate it to anything that must work within the individual in some way, but has become distorted and has shifted its activity to a different domain, a condition such as carcinoma will always remain a relatively unknown factor in human life. Another condition, namely the phenomenon of infantile hydrocephaly, must also be considered in a similar way. Actually, hydrocephaly must exist, and we are all predisposed to it. If it did not exist, the human brain and nervous system would never be able to develop in the right way, because they must be derived from the fluid element that is present within the human being. In childhood, therefore, a struggle is always apparent between hydrocephaly and the process that takes place in the human organization in order to combat it. We should actually never speak of hydrocephaly alone, but should also include its opposite, the loss of too much water in the brain. The latter, a disease that tends to be overlooked, is simply the necessary opposite of hydrocephaly. As little children, we alternate between the two extremes of hydrocephaly and later its opposite. It can happen, and we will consider the treatment more closely later, that we may overlook an important factor in this connection. We may disregard the fact that there is an appropriate We may disregard the fact that there is an appropriate moment for hydrocephaly to disappear, more or less completely, and try to eliminate the hydrocephalic tendency too early, whether through education, diet, or treatment in childhood or in infancy. It is quite possible to make hydrocephaly disappear too early, and if we do so, we will definitely encounter the harm that can be done by failing to consider the person's entire lifespan. Once again, let me point out that this subject would support an entire army of medical theses if we were simply willing to look for the connection between the hydrocephalic process in childhood and syphilis, or the predisposition to syphilis, in later life. There is nothing to be gained by tracking down microorganisms in this instance. There is truly something to be gained only when we are capable of encompassing factors such as I have just laid out. It would do a great deal to prevent syphilis if we made the effort to safeguard people in earnest childhood against what can later appear as syphilitic symptoms, which vary considerably, as we shall hear later. In the course of diagnosis, it is always necessary to remember such connections and to go back to the actual cause as revealed by the course of an individual's development. In this context, the following point is tremendously significant. It can be said that a shift occurs in the entire organic process, both the process in the upper part of the human being that moves down toward the heart, and the process in the lower human being that moves upward toward the heart from the lower part of the abdomen. The human being's entire formative process pushes toward the heart, the actual damming up organ, from both sides. However, this push takes place during different stages of life. If we tackle the symptoms, if we learn how to look at all the symptoms that appear, especially at a younger age, and may ultimately lead to pneumonia or pleurisy in childhood, if we add up everything that plays into these processes, then we discover that this is a displaced process, a process that has shifted. It is the same as the process that comes to expression as hydrocephaly at an even earlier age. It is simply hydrocephaly that has been displaced to a lower level in the human organization, where it develops into a predisposition to pneumonia, pleuritic symptoms, or related childhood symptoms. All of these childhood symptoms have counterpart processes in later life. That is, they return later, but as their polar opposites. Many people would be able to understand all of the processes played out in endocarditis, for example, even acute endocarditis, if they merely investigated the course of disease symptoms earlier in life connected with pneumonia or pleurisy. This should help us to ensure that pneumonia and pleuritic symptoms are not suppressed prematurely or too quickly in children. Parents and teachers naturally want to get rid of such symptoms as quickly as possible, but in these disease states in particular, it is really very important to allow them their own destiny. As a physician, you should intervene only to divert conditions that would otherwise cause damage. Aside from this, you should allow the disease process to run its course to the very end. It is never more important than with the symptoms related to childhood pneumonia or pleurisy, and certain others as well, to implement some kind of physical, or as it is now called, naturopathic treatment. In other words, try to allow the disease process, as much as possible, to run its normal course, without speeding it up or cutting it off prematurely. This is important because such a disease process, if cut off too soon, leads relatively quickly to a predisposition to cardiac disease and related syndromes, and it leads especially to a predisposition to such conditions as polyarthritis. Consequently, it is particularly important to avoid disrupting the disease process in this realm. For many people, simply by not intervening in the intentions of pleurisy and pneumonia, we could eliminate predispositions to all kinds of illnesses that later manifest as cardiac irregularities. The cohesiveness of a person's entire course of development is evident here. At this point, we might also remind ourselves of the need to look at the milder cases of illness that are more easily cured, and not just at the more extreme cases of truly serious illnesses. In fact, at times we may be unable to tell whether we have brought about a cure, or we may simply need to tell a patient not to insist on treatment, since the condition will get better by itself. It can be very important to not do too much curing. There is nothing wrong with being cured, of course, but we must also consider the many individuals who, to their own way of thinking, have experienced all sorts of illness, those who have survived so many different medications and methods of treatment that when they are older, and they are always sick, it is difficult to find anything that reassures them. It would be better to help people understand that in most cases they are not as sick as they think they are. This approach, of course, also has its negative aspects, but it is certainly proper to mention it in this context. Now, however, you must see all of these matters in view of the fact that the human being is complicated and consists of various members. A physical organization, an etheric organization, which has a great deal of work to do between the ages of 7 and 14 in order to penetrate into the physical organism, only to be driven out again during conditions such as pregnancy. An astral body, which begins to work its way in effectively only after the age of 14. And the eye, which finds its way in even later, but in the meantime must not be thought of as outside the body. In the waking state, the eye is never outside the organism. The integration of the eye into the organism enhances the cooperative work that takes place there. In any disturbance in the organism, we are always dealing with the fact that the eye is experiencing certain difficulties in asserting itself within the other members in the right way. It must be said that modern medicine, though it is unaware of this, has the capacity to show how the eye struggles to come to terms with the other three human organizations. It illustrates in an extremely instructive way the struggle of the eye with the other three bodies. We simply fail to recognize these illustrations for what they are, because we live in an age whose philosophy of life is materialistic. Each time you chart a real fever curve, however, you see a precise imprint of the struggle I just characterized. To gain insight into this relationship, there is nothing more illustrative than tracing the fever curves of various disease states. Admittedly, this exercise may be much less important for therapy than it is for pathology, but we do need to understand something about these matters, at least in a general way. You see, understanding a condition like pneumonia or typhoid fever depends on coming to an understanding about the course of the fever as plotted on the chart below. When you study the two main types of fever curves in pneumonia and compare the fever curves of crisis and lysis, you can see how differently the eye, whose intervention in the organism has been disturbed, handles its response in these two instances. In pneumonia, for example, the fever curve, which I am sketching only schematically, shows first the struggle and then the rebound of the eye when the patient's temperature takes a critical dive below normal. The previous exertions of the eye enable it later to effect the rebound. In the other, more lytic course of the illness, lytic is L-Y-T-I-C, L-Y-S-I-S was lysis from before. In the other, more lytic course of the illness, it is less possible for the eye to incorporate the reactions into its own forces, which is why the other, more irregular drop in temperature is the more dangerous course. If you consider the fever curve in typhoid fever, however, you will be able to see especially closely into the entire work of the eye as it confronts the other three organizations. There you have a graphic image of how the eye actually struggles. This example shows that the merger of science and medicine makes it necessary to consider these different human organizations. All the confusion in medical science is due entirely to the fact that science has become materialistic and has restricted itself to observing only the processes of the physical body, whose processes, however, are never independent. Above all, they do not all have equal value in their own way. You see, any given process in the physical body may depend on the fact that the etheric body, or perhaps the astral body, or the eye, is working in it. These are all physical processes, but they become specialized, and the character they assume may vary greatly, depending upon which one of the higher members is at work in that part of the physical organization. Taking all of what I said yesterday about human dependence on supra-earthly and earthly principles, and combining it with what I added today about the human being's temporal course of development, you will realize something that will be helpful with regard to how to conduct the type of investigation that I am discussing. You will realize that forces are constantly being exerted upon the human being. Initially, these are either extra-telluric forces or telluric forces, which work in the opposite direction. In other words, there are either forces that come from Saturn, Jupiter, and Mars, or ones that come from Venus, Mercury, and the Moon, the latter having been transformed into telluric influences. With regard to the relationship between the Earth and the Moon, it is very easy to deceive ourselves about what is going on. It is easy to think that the Moon is up there and exerts its influence from above, but this is incomplete thinking. The Moon is more than just the Earth's companion revolving around it. The same force that is inherent in the Moon and works on the Earth from above is also present within the Earth itself. The Earth has its own moon-like nature, which works out of the Earth from the inside, and there's a drawing. On the physical plane, all the processes that manifest in ebb and flood tides and in many other phenomena, menstruation, for example, are lunar effects rather than actual telluric effects. But they do not result from the direct influence of the Moon, as more recent theories would have it, but rather from the Earth's own moon-like nature. That is why there is an outward correspondence but generally no direct temporal connection between these things. Similarly, when we talk about one of the inner planets, we must also look for its counter-image within the Earth, and then its more physical effects. We must imagine that it is working back into the physical plane from the terrestrial element. What comes about more on the level of soul and spirit must be attributed directly to the planets outside the Earth. In the case of the Moon, it works as follows. The Moon casts certain formative forces onto the Earth, which come to expression by stimulating creative imagination in human beings. The Moon has a great influence on the soul's imaginative creativity. Although they are not adequately taken into account in this materialistic age, such influences are definitely present and will have to be studied at some point. On the level of soul and spirit, the Moon has a strong effect on human creative imagination. The counter-image, the Moon's effect on the organic level, affects the human organization from the opposite direction, working out of the Earth's moon-like nature. This influence is what needs to be taken into account. It also applies to the inner planets that are farther away than the Moon. As we have seen, telluric, localized forces, that is, terrestrial forces, and extra-telluric, localized forces, work on the human being in many different ways. We can study these forces only when we see the result of their cooperative interaction in the entire human being, never in any single part of the human being, and least of all in the single cell. Please take note of this, especially not in the single cell. For what is a cell? A cell is something that stubbornly asserts itself in its own growth and its own life in opposition to what the human being really is. If, on the one hand, you see the entire form of the human being as it is built up by telluric and extra-telluric influences, and on the other hand you consider the cell, you see the cell as a ghostly intrusion into the plans of these initial influences, which it destroys because it wants to develop a life of its own. In the human organism, we are constantly struggling against cellular life. The most crassly absurd view has come about because of cellular pathology and cellular physiology, which take cells as the basis of all life and see the human organism as composed of cells. Actually, the human body is an entirety, an entity that is connected to the cosmos, and as such it always has to combat the stubborn independence of its cells. Essentially, the cell, rather than building up our organism, constantly disturbs it. But of course, now that the basic views of cellular pathology and physiology have infiltrated how we look at everything else, it is not surprising that people come up with the most topsy-turvy ideas about the human body and everything related to it. In a certain way, therefore, we encounter two opposing sets of forces in the human developmental process and the cellular process. Our organs lie between these two sets of forces, and whether an organ develops into a liver or a heart or some other organ depends on which set of forces preponderates. Each organ represents an ongoing balancing act between the two sets of forces I have described. Some of our organs tend at times more toward the cellular aspect, which is then combated by the cosmic aspect. But there are also organs, we will describe them in detail later, in which the cosmic aspect predominates and the cellular moves into the background. From this perspective, it is especially interesting to consider the organs that are located between the genitourinary tract, and the heart. This system of organs demonstrates the greatest similarity to the real intentions of the cells. If you examine the entire human being and consider all the individual organs, you will find the greatest similarity between organs and cell life in this particular part of the body. This leads us to ask, what is actually going on with the cells? Let us exaggerate a little and say that a cell develops a life of its own. The cell develops a life of its own, but this life is continually being counteracted by another influence from outside, by an outer factor that takes the life away from the cell or from the cell's formative forces. It sucks the life out of the cell, leaving it with a drop-like shape. It needs to become common knowledge that everything on earth that assumes a drop shape, regardless of whether it is inside or outside the human being, is the result of two forces, one that wants to manifest life and another that sucks the life out of the first. If we look into ancient medicine's ideas of the mercurial principle, it is interesting to note that the physicians of antiquity saw it as the principle whose life was taken away, leaving it in the form of a drop. In the mercurial principle, they saw something that wanted to become a cell, an independent living drop, but was prevented from doing so by the planetary influences of mercury, and thus became a droplet of mercury, the mere corpse of a cell. There you have the intermediate stage between the salt and the phosphoric principles, and at the same time you can glimpse the admittedly very complicated route we must take to discover how planetary influences are played out in what we encounter on Earth. Each drop of mercury would be a living being if the planet Mercury were not there. And everything in us that tends most strongly toward the cellular aspect, that is, the part of the human being that I just mentioned as lying between the organs of elimination and the heart, is most dependent on being exposed to the planetary influence of Mercury in the right way. If I may put it like this, it is important that these organs preserve their tendency to maintain the cellular aspect, and also that this tendency not be allowed to go so far as to be totally overwhelmed by life. In other words, it is important that these organs continue to be exposed to the mercury principle that paralyzes life or kills it off. The activity of these organs would immediately become rampant if they did not remain in this intermediate state. If we continue to pursue this topic even further, we arrive at the connection that exists between these organs and metallic mercury, which represents the mercury principle. You see, the route we are taking here is a fully rational one. Since it will become increasingly necessary to use outer sense-perceptible facts to confirm what supersensible perception can discover about humankind's present and future states, you would do well to study, both clinically and in the medical literature, how individual minerals and metals, whether of mineral, plant, or animal origin, actually work on the human organism. In this connection, we can begin by studying particularly characteristic features. I told you today that a certain preconceptional tendency needs to work to counteract ossification or sclerosis. Ossifying and sclerotic processes, however, have a polar opposite. To make this opposite proliferate, all you need to do is induce lead poisoning in an individual. Of course, experiments cannot go so far as to actually induce lead poisoning in order to study arterial sclerosis. So the important thing is to keep this in mind as we follow the symptoms that appear when nature does the experimenting for us. In this way, we can discover the inner relationship between lead itself and the factors within the human being that come from the same forces that are active in lead. Following the process that is active in lead and the processes of ossification and sclerosis in the human being is fully in line with our studies. Similarly, it would be possible to study the interrelationship between the process inherent in tin and the interaction I described earlier between hydrocephaly and its opposite. We would find that the same forces that are active in tin are also active in this whole childhood syndrome, whose purpose is to bring about the right degree of hardness in the head and the soft tissues. As we have seen at a later age, this process moves on toward the lungs. We do not need to go very far here. All that is needed is to compile and correctly interpret data that have been noted in the medical literature for centuries. Here we arrive at the intimate relationship between the forces in iron and the process connected to all the symptoms that accompany pneumonia and pleurisy. Once again, we will be able to trace this relationship into the usual process that takes place due to the presence of iron in the blood, where it is more or less normal. If you follow the same process that is played out in the interaction between iron and blood further, into the respiratory system and everything related to it, you will then see how effective iron is in the interaction between hydrocephaly and its opposite, which has shifted into the lungs. You can see how these things interact. Only such interactions and their relationship to what is outside the human being make it possible for us to discover the therapeutic effects of potential remedies. If we truly valued looking at the human being in this way, observers would undoubtedly develop an intuition of sorts that would be an especially important factor in any diagnosis. In this context, it is important to see many different aspects in connection to each other. With each diagnosis, we should look at the individual's current situation in the world, how this person's life has been until now, and how he or she promises to live in the time to come. What do I mean when I say promises to live in the time to come? In a certain way, what a person will experience in the future, especially on the organic level, is definitely present in the form of a potential already present within the individual. If we look for the connection between all I have now said about the effects of lead, tin, and iron on the human organism, and the effects that can emanate from other metals, we find that, in some sense, the effects we have already discussed are the polar opposites of those of copper, mercury, and silver. What I have just said is not intended to promote any specific remedies, but I do need to point out the existence of very specific interactions between the configuration of forces in these metals and in other substances and the formative forces of the human organism itself. Thus, certain forces, such as those associated with copper, will counteract in some way those associated with iron. This will show us which other forces we must use when forces of a certain type, such as those of iron, are present and working too strongly. For example, we will find that very specific pathological symptoms in the human organism show that the iron forces must be too strong. Then it is important to administer copper or a similar remedy, which could also be derived from the plant kingdom. Today's many-sided overview may have asked a bit much of you, I simply hope that if you look at some of what I presented today, you will be able to see how these questions need to be worked out further in order to yield very fruitful results for transforming medical education and our entire system of medicine. The end of Lecture 7.